Here, I will turn things over to your official session moderator, Jeffrey Norcross, who will introduce our seminar and speakers. Jeff?
Hi, everybody. My name is Jeff Norcross, and as Gene said, I'm a member of EPA Region 1's RCRA Lead Region team. Thank you for participating in today's RCRA Expert Brown Bag webinar on the recently finalized post-closure care guidance for hazardous waste facilities approaching the end of the post-closure care period. During today's sessions, our presenters will discuss the scope and approach of the guidance, as well as factors that were considered in developing it. You will also learn about additional recommendations and considerations included in the guidance. It's now my pleasure to introduce today's presenters, Tricia Bazell and Lily Beth Colon. Tricia and Lily Beth work in EPA's Office of Resource Conservation and Recovery. Tricia has been with EPA since 1987, working in Region 6 for 3 years before joining the Office of Resource Conservation and Recovery, or OROCR as we call it, at EPA headquarters. Tricia has extensive experience with RCRA Subtitle C Hazardous Waste Management Program, particularly the areas of permitting, public participation, and corrective action. Lily Beth is an environmental engineer and joined EPA in 2011. She's worked in EPA's RCRA Hazardous Waste Permitting Program and the TSCA PCB Cleanup and Disposal Program. So with that, I want to thank Tricia and Lily Beth for their time and effort and hand it over to them.
Thanks. Excuse me. Thanks, Jeff. This is Tricia Bazell. As Jeff said, I am in the Office of Resource Conservation and Recovery at EPA headquarters. I would like to thank everyone for joining us today. I think this is a really useful guidance, and we're excited to share it with folks. The guidance really is the result of some very deeply collaborative efforts from a very dedicated work group, and it also reflects a lot of the very insightful comments and suggestions we received from a wide group of stakeholders in response to the draft of the guidance that we made available for public review and comment. So, bear with me a second.
You might want to try the button on the screen, and then your keyboard will probably start working.
Yeah, the button on the screen disappeared. Oh, okay. There it is. Got it. Okay. So just a quick overview of what we plan to cover today, and Jeff touched on some of this. We'll give you a quick sense of the objective for today's webinar, a little bit on the background, not just for the guidance, but some of the regulatory background that's behind it. Go through the objective scope and approach of the guidance, and then kind of delve into the guidance itself a bit. So the objective for today is to explain the scope of the guidance and the approach that we've taken for it, as well as some of the factors that came into the development of it, and then to go into a bit more detail on the recommendations that are in the guidance and some of the other considerations that we included as well. Excuse me, allergy season is killing me this year. So we'd like to take a moment or two to walk through the regulatory framework for post-closure. As you know, Congress enacted the Resource Conservation and Recovery Act back in 1976 to ensure the proper management of the huge quantities of waste that were being generated each year. So the RCRA closure and post-closure regulations that are found in 40 CFR Parts 264 and 265, Subpart G, for those of you who know your CFRs, are designed to ensure that when facilities who treat, store, or dispose of hazardous waste cease those activities, the owner or operator closes that facility in a way that's going to be protective of human health and the environment. So closure is the period that follows the active management at a facility during which the facility is no longer accepting or generating hazardous waste for management. And when they're closing the facility, the owner or operator has to remove the waste from the units and decontaminate the equipment, the structures, the soils, and apply final covers to landfills. If the owner or operator of a land disposal facility cannot fully remove that waste or decontaminate everything, then the facility is subject to post-closure care requirements. So again, to repeat, post-closure care only applies to land disposal facilities and facilities that cannot decontaminate, or as we say frequently, clean clothes, so they can't decontaminate all the equipment and structures and soils. So for example, other non-base units such as tanks sometimes might wind up being subject to post-closure care requirements. So the post-closure care period is the period of time after closure during which the owners and operators conduct monitoring and maintenance activities to preserve the integrity of the disposal system and to continue to prevent or to control releases of contaminants from the unit. So again, just to elaborate a bit on the types of activities subject to post-closure care, it really applies to land-based units and facilities that cannot remove the waste or decontaminate. So that would be land disposal units that close with waste in place, units that are, as we say, required to be closed as landfills, and as I said, this could be at tanks from which the waste was released that cannot be clean closed. It could be other land treatment areas. It could be surface impoundments, waste piles, just anyone who couldn't achieve like a clean closure standard. So the RCRA Subtitle C Hazardous Waste Management Regulations found in sections 264, 265, 117. Those are, you know, I think enough of you are familiar with the regs to know that Part 264 deals with kind of the technical standards for facilities that are being permitted. 265 deals with the standards that would apply to facilities operating under interim status, but they're pretty much the same. There's slight variations, but for intents and purposes, 117 and 264 is the same as 117 and 265. So in there, the regs specify that the post-closure care period begins upon completion of closure of the hazardous waste management unit and continues for 30 years. The regulations also, however, provide discretionary authority to the regulatory agency to adjust the length of that post-closure care period as necessary to ensure long-term protectiveness of human health and the environment. So I think it's important to point out that the regulations identification of the 30-year post-closure care period doesn't reflect a determination by EPA that 30 years of post-closure care will necessarily be sufficient to eliminate potential threats to human health and the environment in every instance. If you go back to those early preambles from Federal Register notices when we were first promulgating those rules, they hadn't done like some global assessment to determine like 30 years was going to be protective. It was just a number that people could pretty much wrap their brains around, and because it was such a new area, it just sort of seemed like a good starting place. But the ultimate decision about the appropriate length of that post-closure care period needs to be made on a unit-specific basis. And that's kind of why the regulations provide that discretionary authority to adjust the length of the period as necessary. And actually, I think that's a great example of how there's not always a one-size-fits-all approach, you know, and that's certainly not the way to go. And the regulations provide flexibility in this circumstance to do what makes sense in any given situation. So for permanent facilities, the decision must be made through your permit renewal or modification procedures, and all of those regulations are in Parts 124, which is a section of the CFR that deals with procedures for decision-making, and Part 270, which is where the RCRA permitting regulations are contained. For interim status facilities, adjustments to the post-closure care period must be made in accordance with the interim status standards in 265.118G. But basically, the regulations say that the decision to adjust the length of the post-closure care period can be made at any time preceding partial closure of a hazardous waste management unit that's subject to post-closure care, at any time before you do final closure of a facility, or any time during the post-closure care period for a particular unit. The regulations also provide, in that same section that we're talking about, 264, 265, 117, a couple of examples for when the post-closure care period may be modified. So they say that the period may be shortened where application of advanced technology or alternative disposal, treatment, or reuse techniques indicate that the hazardous waste management unit or facility is secure. And the regs also say that the period may be extended where leachate or groundwater monitoring results indicate a potential for migration of hazardous waste at levels which may be harmful to human health and the environment. So that kind of gives you a sense for what the regulations say and probably don't say about post-closure and the length of the post-closure care period. So now I'd like to delve a little bit more into the objective, scope, and approach of the guidance itself. So, the objective of the guidance really is to assist regulators in evaluating the conditions at hazardous waste disposal facilities that are subject to RCRA Subtitle C post-closure that are nearing the end of that initial 30-year post-closure care period, and to provide some assistance in helping them to determine whether to adjust that period or whether it's okay for it to end. It's also to provide information to assist facility owners and operators in preparing the documentation that's going to help inform those evaluations by the regulators. So the decision lies with the regulatory agency, but the information to support that decision and inform that decision needs to be provided by the facility owners and operators. So another objective of the guidance is that it's going to provide, we think, greater transparency to this whole decision-making process and lend some consistency to the decision-making process. Beyond that, I think the guidance has the additional benefit of helping regulated entities understand what might be necessary to ensure protection of human health and environment at units that are going to be subject to post-closure care. And this will enable those waste generators and handlers to have a better understanding of maybe the costs associated with land disposal, so they can better evaluate their long-term waste management strategies and maybe even look to do a little bit more waste minimization, or look at their supply chains or their processes and figure out how they can do some minimization, kind of get things out of the land disposal arena. So for the scope of the guidance, we want to talk a little bit about what it includes and what it doesn't. So it really does focus on facilities that manage hazardous waste under Subtitle C of RCRA. It's not intended to provide guidance for units that deal with non-hazardous waste, for example, solid waste landfills that are subject to Subtitle D of RCRA. The guidance also provides criteria that we recommend for consideration in ensuring that the human health and the environment will be adequately protected in making decisions about the length of the post-closure care period, whether to extend it, shorten it, or have it end. It sets forth a recommended process for preparing to evaluate that post-closure care period in a timely fashion. So we recommend in the guidance periodic evaluation of all the units that are subject to post-closure care whenever there's a risk to human health and the environment, and we'll go into more detail on some of that. We also very briefly touch on a few related but additional considerations that are a little bit outside the scope of the guidance, but we didn't want to, even though we didn't have all the answers, we didn't want to remain completely silent. And it, like I said, I have sort of walked this through already, it provides some information on the relevant federal regulatory requirements in this area. The guidance is meant to supplement and not replace existing guidance on the post-closure care period. For example, there was a guidance that came out in 1987 that works well with this guidance. We don't see this guidance as replacing that. We see that as supplementing the 87 guidance. The final guidance does also not address financial assurance. If the decision is made to extend a post-closure care period, we really don't go into the mechanics of how you would do financial assurance for an extended post-closure care period. We know that people have questions about that. It is on our radar to continue thinking about, but we thought, you know, we wanted to keep this guidance focused on the technical criteria, and we hope to, you know, in a future endeavor, continue to look at some of these other areas that are related, like financial assurance for extended, but we have not done that yet. It also doesn't get into the whole idea of kind of perpetual obligations. Again, this is just focusing on the site-specific approach, making decisions in the context of the facility or the units at hand. It doesn't globally set anything. Okay, so clearly there are going to be a lot of technical considerations that are going to factor into this decision-making process, and Lily Beth is going to walk us through all of those in just a little bit. But there's also some procedural considerations that really warrant some of our attention. You know, how should people approach the decision-making process? So we included recommendations for handling the procedural steps in this guidance as well. So, you know, as we're saying, for units that are doing their post-closure care under a permit, you know, permits have to come up for renewal no later than every 10 years, considering there is a maximum 10-year permit term, you know, possibly less depending on particular state requirements, but at the federal level, no permit can be issued for a period exceeding 10 years. So if you have a 30-year post-closure care period and 10-year permit terms, you're thinking that that permit's going to come up for renewal a couple times during the post-closure care period. So what we recommend in the guidance is to really do your advanced planning and be prepared. So when, you know, if the facility's coming up for a renewal, you start looking at least 18 months ahead of time to make sure that you're looking at all the relevant information, any monitoring results from any testing or inspections of the cover systems, any information available concerning the anticipated land use or institutional controls that may be in place. You know, and if you start to wrap your hands around that, you can see, okay, am I going to need more information in order to make this decision? And you could start working early on in that process with the facility owners and operators to get that information. Starting the process early will be key to determining if any changes to the post-closure care period or to the activities that need to be conducted during the post-closure care period need to be made and reflected in the permit renewal. If it's a unit that's conducting their post-closure care under interim status, of course, you're not going to have the same permitting timeframes. You don't have a permit that's going to come up for renewal. But we still suggest that regulators adopt timeframes for review similar to those under permitting. So if a facility is doing their post-closure under interim status, you should still be checking in, you know, every 8.5 years or so, because that would be a year and a half before a permit renewal timeframe, to start looking at the information for that interim status unit and making sure that you have everything you need to inform your decision-making process. And I think for both situations, whether it's a permitted unit or a unit operating under interim status or doing their post-closure under interim status, also keep in mind that the post-closure plan itself, which is an element of the permit, if it's a permitted unit, but a separate document for interim status, might need to be reviewed to determine if that needs to be updated as well as the permit. Okay, so as we said, sort of when we're talking about the regulatory overview, the regulatory authority is the one responsible for deciding whether to extend or shorten the length of the post-closure care period, and the facility owner operator is responsible for making sure that they provide the information to inform that decision. And normally, that kind of requirement is written into a permit, or it's I think it's in the interim status regulations as well, or it could be part of an EPA order if there's an order governing the post-closure care. And in the guidance, we indicate that a lack of relevant information may justify a conclusion by the regulatory authority that the post-closure care period should be extended to ensure protection of human health and the environment until such time as that information becomes available and can be used to more fully inform the decision-making process. So this is an important point coming up here on this slide. You know, really an overarching consideration in determining whether to extend or shorten post-closure care period is the inherent uncertainty associated with the long-term presence of hazardous waste in the unit. Continued monitoring and maintenance activities may be appropriate unless or until it can be demonstrated that site-specific conditions adequately minimize the risk that the contaminants will migrate from the unit, you know, for example, the site geology or hydrogeology, or that in the event the engineering control fails, you know, if the liner is breached and things go out, that the release wouldn't pose an unacceptable risk to human health and the environment, so kind of looking towards the receptors a bit. And really, as you know, considering when the regulations were first promulgated, we're really coming up at the end of the initial 30-year post-closure care period for many of these units and facilities, and the closer we get to that, we've been getting more and more questions about how people are supposed to approach this decision-making process, especially given all of these inherent uncertainties with leaving waste in place. We've received multiple requests to provide clarification. We heard from the Association of State and Territorial Solid Waste Management Officials, ASWAMA. We've heard from individual states. We've heard from members of the regulated community, from our partners in the EPA regional offices. So we knew we had to do something. And, you know, if you remember back a few slides when we talked about the examples that were in the regulations for when the post-closure care period could be modified, again, it was like, you know, for shortening it, it's if the application of advanced technology or alternate disposal, treatment, or reuse techniques might indicate that the facility is secure. For extending it, it's where leachate or groundwater monitoring results indicate a potential for migration at levels that might be harmful to human health and the environment. And really, those examples clearly don't provide a wealth of information for people to work with. So that pretty much leads us to kind of precisely why we initiated the development of this guidance, because we needed to bridge that gap between the regulatory framework and some very real implementation considerations that people were bumping up against very, very quickly. So I know I covered a lot of information pretty quickly, but I hopefully gave you a sense of the regulatory framework that's on the book and some background on kind of the need for the guidance. So we want to shift gears to the guidance itself at this point. Here's a sort of a general outline for the guidance. We've touched on some of these items already. I think we've kind of really taken care of the introduction and need for the guidance, the regulatory overview, and the recommended approach for reviewing the units approaching the end of their period. So I think now we will turn to the meat of the matter and the technical criteria we recommend that people assess when approaching a determination about adjusting the length of the post-closure care period. And for that, I will turn the mic over to Lily Beth, our resident environmental engineer, and illustrious team lead on this project.
Oh, thank you so much, Tricia. Well, hello, everyone. Thanks for joining us. We are now going to talk about the criteria presented in the guidance for evaluating the post-closure care period. All right. The criteria which you are now seeing on this slide can be used to evaluate site-specific conditions and the associated risks and uncertainties that Tricia mentioned that are when you are determining whether to adjust the post-closure care period. There are some important things to keep in mind when evaluating the criteria, and one of them, and perhaps the more important, the most important, is that each criterion relates to the potential for releases and migration of hazardous waste from the regulated unit. So when considering each criterion, we need to keep in mind the overarching consideration of inherent uncertainties associated to the long-term presence of hazardous waste. And let me give you some examples. There are often uncertainties in whether controls will continue to function as planned in the future. And that's why we need to look into unit design aspects and the integrity of the containment system. In other instances, even if there's no evidence of actual releases from the facility, significant factors could change over time, such as groundwater flow, and that's why we need to look into the geology and hydrogeology conditions of the site, as well as to take into account the long-term considerations, among other things. Another example is that landfill components, such as caps and liners, can degrade over time, especially if maintenance is discontinued. Thus, the criteria that we are presenting in the guidance can help you identify whether the site-specific conditions at some point will adequately minimize the risk that contaminants will migrate from the unit, or that in the event of an engineering control failure, a release would not pose an unacceptable risk to human health and the environment. Other things to keep in mind is that the criteria can also be periodically used to evaluate whether activities in the post-closure plan should be amended, and this includes the frequency of the monitoring and maintenance activities. Also, the criteria descriptions that are in the guidance include questions to help you identify potential threats to human health and the environment, but you don't necessarily need to answer all of them in order to come up with your answer. Lastly, each criterion is not necessarily applicable to every unit in post-closure care, and an example would be the gas collection system integrity criterion, which obviously would not apply to units without a gas collection system. So let's now move into each specific criterion. Waste treatment. And All right, can you see the slide well?
We can.
Okay, excellent. I'm adjusting it a little. Okay, so about waste treatment, whether the hazardous waste was disposed prior to the effective date of the land disposal restrictions or the LDR program is a very important piece of information under this criterion. And we want you to find out whether the hazardous waste was treated. And that's because hazardous waste treatment that destroys harmful contaminants or reduces toxicity of the waste before placement in a land disposal unit provides a more lasting form of groundwater protection than waste containment alone. So you would like to know, were all the waste pre-treated in accordance with the treatment standards of the LDR program? Or does the unit contain waste that were placed on the land prior to the effective dates of the LDR rules? Now, talking about nature of hazardous waste. Here, you want to evaluate the current properties of the hazardous waste, for instance, degradation, solubility, liquid to solid ratio. And in this criterion, the properties provides an important indication of the waste's ability to migrate or disperse in the environment. Therefore, an evaluation of the toxicological, chemical, and physical properties of a waste determine how widely the waste might be dispersed in the environment. An example I like to give is if a unit does not have a bottom liner and contains toxic waste that have not been treated or solidified and which pose a significant environmental hazard due to their persistence and mobility, all else being equal, it may be appropriate to consider extending the post-closure care period. So some questions under this criterion include, what is the degree of risk presently associated with the waste in the unit? Are the wastes highly toxic? Do they degrade into substances that are more or less toxic or non-toxic? Is the waste in a stable state? Are there indications that the waste may become unstable? So we recommend that current data from regulatory standards be used for comparison to specific performance goals articulated in the post-closure plan. We also recommend that as necessary, the plan be updated to account for any new information on toxicity and carcinogenity. We also recommend, among other things, because I'm trying to summarize some of the recommendations here, that we recommend that the data gathered should include an analysis of the potential degradation products and not just the types of waste known to have been placed in the unit originally. So moving on into the unit type slash design criterion, the main objective, as you all know, of the disposal unit is the containment of the hazardous waste. Thus, emphasis should be placed on the unit's ability to contain hazardous waste over the long term. Some of the questions we want you to consider under this criterion are, is the unit, for example, a landfill, a surface impoundment, or a closed tank with residual contamination? Does the unit meet the minimum technology requirements, such as double liners, leachate collection system, or was the unit already in existence at the time these requirements were promulgated? Because many of these facilities are really old. To what extent does the overall design and construction of the unit minimize the need for long-term maintenance, resist the generation of leachate and emission, and contain any remaining waste in perpetuity, perhaps? Also, EPA recommends that you consider that there can be circumstances in which continuing to maintain unit-specific controls may be necessary to ensure protection of human health and the environment, and this is particularly true if the unit predated the minimum technological requirements. And the opposite is also true. There might be circumstances where the overall design and construction of the unit minimize the need for long-term maintenance and could support a decision to shorten the post-closure care period. Moving on into the next criterion, which is leachate. The leachate collection and removal system controls leachate buildup on the liner and works in conjunction with the liner's barrier system to minimize the potential for groundwater contamination. Under this criterion, we want you to be cognizant of the fact that monitoring for leachate generation serves as the most effective way of examining the integrity of the waste management unit. And an example is that it can suggest a cover or liner failure when leachate is detected late in the post-closure period. And some questions under this criterion include, will the integrity and functionality of the leachate collection system, leachate generation rate, and leachate quality remain adequate to prevent harm to human health and the environment in the absence of post-closure care? Can the facility owner or operator show through monitoring, modeling, or statistical analysis that the leachate could not pose a threat to human health and the environment because it would not exceed applicable standards at compliance or exposure points? Is it likely those standards will be exceeded in the future, for example, through formation and release of degradation products? We recommend that you consider the potential impacts from changes in leachate characteristics and generation rates that could result from discontinued maintenance. So now speaking about groundwater. We believe that it is very important that before the post-closure care period ends or near its end, you evaluate the groundwater analytical results, the adequacy and reliability of the groundwater monitoring network, and the groundwater monitoring well integrity. And it's because we believe that groundwater monitoring serves as a primary means of detecting leachate releases and groundwater contamination. And there's a couple of other important things here. We believe that groundwater should not exceed risk-based concentrations for a reasonable exposure scenario or point of exposure using currently acceptable risk assessment methods and up-to-date risk-based levels and scenarios. Another important point is if the evaluation determines that an acceptable risk exists, these risks should be addressed. And in your risk evaluation, you should consider reasonable current or future groundwater use in the general area of the site. We also think that it is important that your review of the groundwater monitoring system is done as part of operation and maintenance inspections over time. Some questions under this criterion include, is groundwater quality in compliance with current standards? Do the data indicate any trend in the concentration of analyzing groundwater? And have the monitoring wells been maintained to provide valid data, for example, no well screen occlusion? So let's talk about siting and site geology / hydrogeology now. And here, we recognize that many sitings, geologic and hydrologic conditions affect the performance of the cover or containment system. And relevant facility information characteristics that you should consider might include proximity to vulnerable areas, such as residential areas, and surface and drinking water sources. Other considerations to take into account under this criterion are location in potentially vulnerable areas, for example, if units are located in areas prone to flooding or with high water table, it might be appropriate for reviewers to consider the potential for continuing risks to surface water in evaluating whether to modify the post-closure care period. But the opposite also applies. If a unit is located in an area that is not prone to flooding or at great distance from the water table, this might have less need for long-term maintenance. Also, proximity to residential areas can present unique considerations, and it might be appropriate to consider whether the facility conditions would minimize the potential for adverse impacts on local populations. Under this criterion, we want you to evaluate things such as, is the unit located in a dry climate that provides minimal precipitation? Is the pattern of land use changing? Is it likely to change in the future? Is there a sizable buffer zone around the facility? Have new potential exposure pathways been identified? And these are just some examples of the things we included under that criterion. So moving on to facility history, and I think this is a relatively easy one, and that's because a well-managed facility is more likely to maintain its structural integrity. Good maintenance and early interventions are key in ensuring that the unit continues to be effective in the future. So I don't want you necessarily waiting until you have a bigger issue before repairing the components that need to be repaired. Some management practices that help demonstrate whether the unit has been adequately managed are good compliance records, routine maintenance and inspection, emergency procedures to handle natural disasters. Have you seen those? Is the facility prompt and efficient in responding to spill and other incidents? We want you to evaluate, is there a history of any releases? What are current contaminant levels? If a release did occur, have corrective measures been successfully implemented? Are analysis being conducted for the correct parameters, or are you measuring the wrong ones? How complete and accurate is the facility operating record? Those are just a few to summarize. The gas collection system, where applicable, it is very important to analyze the extent to which the gas collection system is capable of being modified or shut down at the end of the post-closure care period without exceeding emission levels. And this should be consistent with both applicable regulatory standards and with public safety at the facility. In addition, because gas emissions can change and could increase or decrease over time, we recommend that you not just look at the numbers, but that you statistically or graphically analyze the data to identify any significant changes in gas emissions. Next page. Considering the integrity of covering system, as the slide reads, a viable cover is the most important mechanism in preventing leachate generation and ultimately releases of contaminants. As most of you know, we anticipate cracks, burrows from animals, and other problems that are likely to occur after termination of post-closure care. And if testing and inspection end, these problems could go undetected and releases could occur. Thus, we think it is vital to evaluate the performance of the cover system during the post-closure care period. Things like, has the cover system been designed and maintained to minimize migration of water into the management unit and to prevent contaminants from escaping into the environment? Has periodic testing or inspection been conducted to identify and assure any necessary repairs? And here, again, we worried about differential settlement, problems with cover integrity like cracks, cover drainage, et cetera, et cetera. Is the remaining waste likely to be so benign that even with a compromised cover system, release of hazardous constituents is unlikely? Those are just a few of the questions you can consider under that criterion. For the long-term care criterion, this concept of long-term care, also known as long-term stewardship, generally includes the establishment and maintenance of physical and legal controls that are necessary to prevent unacceptable exposure to human health and the environment. And as a general matter, we believe that RECRA post-closure care requirements, for example, monitoring and cap maintenance, fall under the long-term care umbrella. So when considering whether to adjust the post-closure care period, permitting authorities should evaluate any continuing need to maintain engineering controls and particularly those specified in the RCRA post-closure care regulations. The guidance goes on to say that a further need to maintain engineering controls could justify an extension of the post-closure care period, but that's even if the frequency of some activities could be adjusted. And we include the frequency of activities because some activities might be needed more frequently in the early years of post-closure and less frequently later on. And then the guidance talks a little bit about institutional controls, and we also recommend that institutional controls needed beyond the post-closure care period be in place before the period ends. Another recommendation we make is that consideration be given as to whether a funding source is available to support any necessary engineering or institutional controls. And here we try to provide an example because we say we think that you could perhaps do that as part of an anticipated future use or end use strategy, and ideally that strategy would generate revenue so protective controls at the unit can be continued while supporting beneficial reuse of the land into the future. And we recognize that more work needs to be done in this area, but we wanted to send the right signals into, hey, why don't we start looking at end-use strategies that could potentially generate revenue? So that's the criteria. And yes, there's a lot of questions, a lot of things to think through and consider, and that's why we said start early. Okay, other additional considerations. And this is something we have been working on, work in this area is still ongoing, but we wanted to include the benefits of the post-closure care permits. And just for those who might be new, you know, permits are site-specific legal documents that establish the technical and administrative conditions to which a facility must adhere in order to ensure that monitoring and maintenance activities are performed to prevent and address releases that could potentially threaten public health and the environment. So we believe that it is critical that any modifications to the permit are made as necessary to ensure that those permits are complete and current. And although we recognize that there are resources associated with permit maintenance, we hear you, there's a lot of resources associated with that, but permits also provide numerous benefits and protections, such as basic permitting requirements, like application requirements, standard permit conditions, such as the duty to comply, duty to reapply. That all comes with a permit, duty to provide information, and monitoring and reporting requirements. Other benefit is unit-specific informational requirements. And here, where applicable, owners and operators of a unit must submit information, including detailed plans. So that comes with a permit as well. Financial assurance. The owner or operator must establish and maintain financial assurance requirements in accordance with the approved post-closure plan for as long as the unit remains subject to post-closure care requirements. That's a benefit to the permit. Corrective action. The regs require that Section 264.101 requires that all permits include requirements for facility-wide corrective action as necessary to protect human health and the environment. Other benefit, enforceability. The permitting authority can enforce a RCRA permit, can enforce the RCRA permit requirements, including facility inspections, record reviews, and other means. Public participation, that's another benefit. The public has the opportunity to comment on a facility's closure and post-closure plan as part of the initial permitting process, as well as with any amendments made to the plans as part of the permit modification procedures. Other benefits include additional conditions that you can include under the omnibus authority that allows for additional site-specific permit conditions to be incorporated into the RCRA permit if those are necessary to protect human health and the environment. as well as other, you know, I can continue on and on, but as well as other benefits, such as the fact that the permit requirements cannot be terminated merely by sale of the property or bankruptcy of the owner or operator. So yes, there's some work related to permits, but there's also associated benefits. Other considerations on the next slide, we recommend that the regulatory agency consider extending the post-closure care period when corrective action continues beyond the original post-closure period. Another consideration is that state, and I want to emphasize this one, state programs may be broader in scope, and they can be more stringent than EPA's RCRA's hazardous waste regulations, and their requirements can vary from state to state. Other considerations is that we believe that at a minimum, it's important to make a decision about the length of the post-closure care period and to document such decision well before that period nears the end. And this is a very important piece of advice because the documentation part is very, very wise for you to do because you might have multiple permit writers or people might be retiring. So it would be very wise for you to document all the decisions. Another very important thing to consider is that any proposal to adjust the post-closure care period should be supported by adequate data and analysis to demonstrate the anticipated long-term performance of the unit. And to go further, in order to account for cyclical fluctuations in weather and hydrogeology, we recommend that multiple year performance data be considered, at least 10 years, 5 years. And we have heard that some facilities might not be keeping historical data. And you are likely gonna need that in order to be able to analyze some trends. So that's something to keep in mind.
Okay, this is Trish. I'm going to jump in. Mm-hmm. It's a surprise to all of us, but there's a couple of things that have come up since we developed the guidance that I just want to give a shout out to. As Lily Beth was saying, we understand the resource constraints that people have with permitting resources and that renewals can take up some burden. And I just want to give a shout out to an effort that EPA Region 1 did with the State of Massachusetts Department of Environmental Quality on they did one of our lean events to streamline the permit renewal process, and they've put together a really fantastic toolkit I don't have the link handy, but we can make sure it gets out to people, that provides some tools to help that other regulators can avail themselves of to help streamline that process. Also, in the process of developing this guidance, we started to realize in some of the conversations we were having that there were some issues with how people were implementing the post-closure rule. When the post-closure rule was put in place, it provided additional flexibilities for post-closure care to happen under some other enforceable document other than a permit. And really what that was intended, I believe, was so if you were doing post-closure care under interim status, say you decided to close rather than pursue a permit when the regulations came out, instead of having to get a permit to do that post-closure, you could do it under some other document. The intent was not for people to end the permits and then have the post-closure happen under another document, because when you issue a permit and then end that permit, you lose certain enforcement authorities that otherwise would be available to you. So you're kind of narrowing your options over time if you do that. So that's kind of elaborating a bit on the benefit of a permit from the enforceability perspective. So I just wanted to make those two plugs.
Right.
Okay, so then
we open it up to you guys. Do you have any questions?
Thanks, Tricia and Lily Beth. This is Jeff. I will read off some of the questions we have. For some reason, I'm having trouble getting the questions to stay on my screen, but here we go. Given that hazardous waste may be left indefinitely in place, wouldn't that mean that PCC will be required in perpetuity because of future uncertainty?
This is Trish. I'll try and field that one, and Lily Beth can jump in. It would depend on the outcome of the assessment. If you look at all of these criteria that we have put in the guidance and you go through the questions that are posed and try and answer the ones that are relevant to that situation, that should lead you to a point where you can decide whether it's okay for the period to stay at 30 years or whether you think that sufficient risk remains that you need to extend it. It doesn't necessarily mean that because waste is left in place, you'll have to be in post-closure care forever.
Right. And the key here is whether the site-specific conditions at the site minimize that uncertainty. So you acknowledge what the uncertainty that you have, and then you go and study out, you know, evaluate all the site-specific conditions. And the key here is, like, even in the absence of post-closure care, if something were to happen, would those site-specific conditions minimize the impact? If the answer to that, after you consider everything altogether, because I cannot say, oh, you have to take into account this criterion over the other. No, you have to do a holistic assessment. And after that, if the answer is, well, even if something were to happen, even if the containment unit fails, would that pose a significant risk of impact to human health and the environment, then the answer is likely to be yes, you need to extend. But if the answer is this is located in a remote place, the weather is a dry area, I don't have sensitive receptors, I don't have population in the area, residents, the waste is not toxic. All those things would argue to a finite or shorter or 30-year period.
Or you have a menu strategy. You have a plan for putting that land back into reuse, and that plan for reuse is going to preserve the integrity of your containment, then that might work too. I mean, all those things would factor into the decision. So, next question.
Yes, thanks. We have like four or five more questions. We can go over if we need to. So folks
okay.
on the line, feel free to stay after two if that.
Yes, but before you move on to the next question, on page four, for the person who asked this question, on page four, I would direct that person to the first paragraph there where we say, thus, continued monitoring and maintenance activities may be appropriate unless or until it can be demonstrated that site-specific conditions adequately minimize the risk that contaminants will migrate from the unit or that in the event the engineering controls fail, a release would not pose an acceptable risk to human health and the environment. I think that's the basis of the guidance.
Yeah.
You apply your criteria and until you can demonstrate that the site-specific conditions minimize the risk, you would have to continue. But we do not get into perpetual care. It's a site-specific decision and it's an ongoing evaluation that you need to do.
Okay, thanks. The second question, if the basis for determining the disposal facility is stable, is done during the time that it is being well maintained, how can we assume that those conditions will remain constant if maintenance is not being performed?
Could you repeat the question?
We missed kind of the first part of the question.
Yeah, so it's kind of presenting a bit of a scenario. So if the basis for determining the disposal facility is stable, is done at the time when it is being well maintained, how can we assume if maintenance drops off that conditions will remain constant?
Well, you know, I think that's one of the reasons why in the guidance we talk about in the absence of continued post-closure care, will things continue to prevent migration or risk to human health and the environment. So I don't think you can necessarily make that assumption, so you have to do your research. You have to look and see, okay, if, God forbid, something terrible were to happen, if we let this facility end its post-closure care, as Elizabeth was saying, you know, what does the site geology look like? What are the conditions? Where are the receptors? If there's no receptors, is it a, you know, is it going to matter kind of thing? So it's
right. So you would be assuming some changes, but even when the changes happen, what's the impact going to look like?
Okay. Thanks. The next question, should end use or reuse be a part of an initial evaluation of PCC or maybe even before?
I would say that you can evaluate, it can be at either at the beginning or as part of a re-evaluation, I think.
I think more often than not,
right,
it's probably going to come during sort of a reevaluation because the whole idea of reuse is a much newer concept than the original post-closure care regs. But I think we know that we don't say a ton in this area in the guidance, and that's because under our cleanup programs, there is work evolving. Policy is still evolving in this area for sort of long-term and reuse and potential reuse of land. And because that policy area is still under development, we didn't want to go out with something that would curtail their flexibility to look
right.
at the issue as broadly as they could.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Right. And at the same time, we are not necessarily ready to say a lot, but we wanted to steer your creative juices.
Exactly.
Because the regulations don't close the door on that.
Right.
Because if you look at the examples they give for when you can shorten the post-closure care period, they mention things like application of advanced technology. That's something that's in the reg.
Yep.
Alternative disposal treatment.
Or reuse techniques.
That indicate that the hazardous waste management unit or disposal facility is secure. So if the regulations included that in there, we wanted to emphasize that a little bit so we can continue the discussion.
Yeah, because especially if that land can be put into some sort of economically viable reuse scenario that would help fund, so you could even combine and you could still have it self-fund might not be quite the right phrase, but to if you wanted to make sure that you had some monitoring or maintenance going on, even if it is in a reuse scenario, those are not incompatible factors.
Right.
So.
And we think that, you know, an example we have given is like passive solar panels, you know, things that would not compromise the structure, would not compromise the system, but at the same time help you generate revenue because we do recognize that there are costs associated with this practice. So how can we find common ground where we make sure that the unit is still protective to human health and the environment, but that we have the resources to pay for the long-term care operation?
Yeah, especially if it prevents using up green space to accomplish that goal instead. So.
Thanks. I think we'll do three more questions.
Okay.
First one I'm going to ask is, what is clean closure? Where is it defined in the regulations? Is it based on regional screening levels?
I am reading here. I'm looking.
You know,
I have a memo, and I believe the guidance cites that memo. I'm trying to find the citation, but there's a memo that was issued by EPA that provided guidance on what clean closure means.
There's a risk-based clean closure memo that was signed by Liz Cotsworth. But going back to the initial question, I don't think the term clean closure is actually defined by regulation. But the regulations, the closure regs in 264 and post-closure, go through what we were saying before, that when you close, you have to remove waste from the unit, decontaminate all equipment, structures, soil. And if you can't do that, then you're not achieving what we refer to as clean closure.
Right. And on page 2 of the guidance, footnote number 1, you can find the clean closure, the risk-based clean closure memo, where you could leave some constituents, remove everything, and decontaminate, even when you are leaving some constituents. But please read the memo, which is more, you know, don't quote my answer. Read the memo would be my recommendation.
Okay, thanks. The next question is, would it make sense to move a unit from post-closure to corrective action if the rest of the facility is managed that way?
Well, I mean, we touched on that a little bit, because, you know, there are all sorts of complicated situations, as we all know, that arise, and you can sometimes have a regulated unit in the midst of solid waste management units, and how do you deal with this holistically? So that was one of the reasons why we say, you know, if your corrective action period is going to go beyond a post-closure care period, and these things are all kind of together, you may want to think about extending the post-closure care period to be coterminous with your corrective action period, so that you can do things holistically. I mean, we're all for supporting flexibility as much as possible and as much as makes sense.
Right. But at the same time, by making the periods coterminous, you would still have your permit with all the benefits of it. And in case there are further releases, you still have your permit. You still have authority to compel additional cleanup. The other consideration would be the post-closure care rule. I think envision a scenario where you have commingled releases, but that's a very particular scenario. And like Tricia said, the intent of the post-closure rule wasn't to terminate permits, right? It was to compel corrective action for those facilities that didn't have a permit, while affording some flexibilities where it made sense. But I would refer people to the post-closure rule and the documents we have online that explain the post-closure rule in more detail.
Okay. Thanks. And this will be the last question, and I apologize to folks who submitted questions that we're not getting to, but I tried to pick the questions that covered common ground. So this question is, if the post-closure period is terminated, the agency loses regulatory control of the facility. Under what mechanism would ongoing necessary long-term care requirements be enforced, and what about financial assurance?
Okay, so like we're saying, that some of those are a little bit beyond the scope of the guidance. Like I said, we made a conscious decision not to delve into how to do financial assurance for extended post-closure care. We figured that would be a different group of experts to bring into the room instead of the engineers. It would be more some of the finance folks who are kind of subsumed with some other rulemaking efforts going on at the moment. Missed the first part of the question.
So it's a scenario
if
again.
If you let out of a permit, yeah.
Yeah.
So, again, that's why, you know, you do lose some of your tools from your toolbox if you let somebody out of a permit.
Right.
You don't have all your same enforcement suite of tools available to you, which is what we're trying to say, like, you know, kind of pointing out to people the benefits of permits.
Right.
That doesn't mean that you can't decide to let somebody out of permit. And you know, the people that are closest to these facilities, like you know, the people in the states or the regions that are working with these firsthand and working with the facility owners and operators will have a better sense of what to do in a given situation. But, you know, if you've got another mechanism in place, if you let them out of your RCRA mechanism, because you maybe have a good environmental covenant in your state, because, you know, we have the Uniform Environmental Covenant Act that created these things, but they've been adopted with some changed language across the states. They're not all the same, so some states have better covenants than others, we're told. So if you're in a situation where you think you've got a real strong environmental covenant that gives you financial assurance, that gives you access to the facility to check on things or if things happen, then maybe you would be comfortable allowing your RCRA control to end.
Right. But at the same time, you might be missing some things
right.
from the permit itself. And this is, the permits have already been enforced. This is what EPA has done before. We have heard that environmental covenants could be enforced again.
Mm-hmm.
Even EPA could
yeah.
could do that, but we haven't done it yet.
Yeah, because some of those cases, I mean, I think under a Superfund environmental covenant, there's been some things where EPA successfully defended or enforced against those covenants, but it hasn't really, from what I've been told, hasn't necessarily been tried in the RCRA context yet. So whereas some of our attorneys think that they could prevail, it just hasn't been tried yet. So that's why there is a separate long-term stewardship group that is looking at a lot of these issues, and I believe working on some sort of paper that will come out at some point. I'm not sure their time frame.
Yeah, so I think that the more appropriate answer to that question is that there's more work in this area.
Yeah, this guidance is not the last word by any stretch of the imagination, because, you know, we're starting here. We're giving you criteria to help inform those decisions. We know there is more work to be done in this area, and it is definitely on our radar to continue it.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Lily Beth and Tricia. At this point, I will turn things back over to Jean.
All right, thank you so very much, Jeff. I'm going to walk through just a few quick reminders and then let everyone carry on with the rest of their day as we go ahead and close out today's session. We had over 370 individuals join us from all over the country for today's RCRA Experts webinar, and I want to thank those individuals who took time out of their schedules to sit in, as well as our organizers and presenters who helped put on today's session. We hope that you can join us on the next RCRA Expert session, which will cover EPA's RCRA training website, looking at training resources for EPA states and tribes. That session has been scheduled for Wednesday, August 2nd, where we'll be joined by Gail Hansen from the Office of Resource Conservation and Recovery. You can sign up for that particular session on the URL shown here. For those of you who are looking for copies of the presentation materials, we have those already loaded as a PDF file that you can download from the links or resources page. If you can't click on the links on the screen, if you look on the middle right under related URLs, you should see a link to seminar resources. Just click on it and press the Browse You button to open it up. If you happen to be replaying today's recorded webinar, you can still click those links and open up the resources. We do have information about our presenters and organizers, as noted, from the seminar homepage if you'd like to reach out to them. And I will ask if you could take just a brief moment to fill out our online feedback form and let us know what you thought both of what we covered today and how we covered it using our webinar platform. If you shared the line with multiple people, each person can fill out that feedback form. And that might be of interest because many of you ask for participation certificates to document your attendance. When you fill out the online feedback form, as soon as you check the box at the bottom certifying you are here for the whole session and send in your feedback form, you'll immediately have access to a PDF certificate that you can download or print out. So again, each person can fill out that feedback form and get their own participation certificate, regardless if you shared the attendance under one line. And please know I do read each and every one of the submissions that comes in there, and we do count on your feedback to continue to offer these sessions. Today's seminar was recorded, and you'll automatically receive an email as soon as the archived version is available for on-demand playback. And so with that, we'll go ahead and formally close things out today. I want to thank everyone for joining us, and hopefully you'll be on for our next RCRA Expert.